Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's May 1st, 2014 7th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 12-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 12. Margaret Gatti will discuss OFAC sanctions and compliance requirements for hedge funds. Now, on to the podcast.
Good afternoon, everyone. So I'm going to talk about OFAC sanctions and compliance requirements that you may or may not be aware of. But certainly, as we look at OFAC and as you read the news, you see that OFAC is getting a lot of press attention. Maybe you've seen OFAC in connection with fines that OFAC has levied against many large banks, the Standard Chartered Bank, Lloyds Bank. There have been many banks recently fined, Bank of Tokyo. It goes on and on with multiple million, hundreds of millions of dollars of fines, some of them even stretching into the billion. And there's one pending now, which I understand may be a fine of $2 billion. So you probably have read about the sanction cases involving the banks. Probably you're also reading about OFAC sanctions as it comes to the Ukraine-related sanctions, you know, Ukraine, Crimea, and Russia. And there have been many sanctions released, and they will continue to be released. So with that as hopefully something that grabs your interest, I'm going to talk about OFAC and give you kind of an update on where we stand with the Russia-Ukraine sanctions. Then I'm going to talk about compliance requirements. What do you have to do to comply with OFAC requirements? And I'm going to try to make it specific to what I understand you all do, hedge funds. But as Tim mentioned, it gets involved in investors in hedge funds and investments made by hedge funds, and to the extent that you have any managers involved, investments that they make. What are OFAC sanctions? Well, generally, they're a foreign policy tool, which is used very frequently. It's a relatively small government agency. It's part of the Department of Treasury. And the OFAC, which stands for Office of Foreign Asset Control, is used by the president to impose sanctions against foreign targets that are deemed to pose a threat to national security, U.S. foreign policy, or the U.S. economy. And these sanctions are administered and enforced, by the Office of Foreign Asset Control. Now, that enforcement is civil enforcement, but there's also criminal enforcement, but that falls outside of OFAC. That's within the Department of Justice. So OFAC has responsibility for administering sanctions and has responsibility for enforcing the civil penalties related to sanctions. And OFAC, as I mentioned, is an agency of the Department of Treasury. The legal jurisdiction, the laws underlying the OFAC sanctions are two. And one of them is a longstanding law that we affectionately, in acronym style, refer to as TWIA. And TWIA stands for Trading with the Enemy Act. And that is the legal basis for the older sanction regimes. The only sanction regime that's currently based on TWIA is the Cuban sanction regime. You know, and that goes back to when Castro nationalized, you know, investments in Cuba. The other legal basis is the basis of all the newer sanctions and all the sanctions that are being levied right now. And that other law is, again, affectionately referred to by an acronym called IEEPA, and that stands for International Emergency Economic Powers Act. So those two laws are the legal underpinnings of all OFAC sanction programs. Now, of course, there are various executive orders issued to dictate new sanctions, and then ultimately OFAC will enact regulations for the sanction programs. OFAC targets two different areas. It targets countries, and these are countries whose actions are determined to constitute a threat to U.S. national security, U.S. foreign policy, and the U.S. economy. OFAC also targets individuals or entities. And same basis, these individuals or entities are deemed to be involved in or to be contributors to activities which are deemed to constitute a threat to U.S. national security, U.S. foreign policy, or the U.S. economy. Each OFAC sanction program is different. So I can't really make any broad generalizations and say, you know, Cuba, Iran, North Korea, Sudan, and Syria are all the same. They're not. They have different sets of regulations. They define terms differently. So if I look, for example, at the definition of U.S. person, I'm going to see a different definition depending on which sanction program I'm in. So that's a key point to keep in mind as you sit here today, and that is that each of these sanction programs is different. So you can't make any generalizations in talking about them. At the moment, as of April 2014, and even as of today, in fact, there are 25 different sanction programs that are administered by the Office of Foreign Asset Control. And you'll see that some of these use the word related. So, for example, we have the Balkans-related, the Belarus-related, the Burma sanctions, the Cote d'Ivoire sanctions-related, the counter-narcotics trafficking sanctions, counter-terrorism sanctions, so that targets behavior as opposed to countries and individuals. I'm not going to really focus on those behavior programs today, but I thought it was important for you to understand that that is an area that is sanctioned by OFAC. Cuba sanctions, which have been around a long time, the DR Congo-related sanctions, the Iran sanctions, which are very robust, and we'll talk about them a little bit, the Iraq-related sanctions, Lebanon-related, Liberia-related, Libya-related, non-proliferation sanctions, again, another activity where people who are found to have engaged in non-proliferation activities are sanctioned. North Korea, rough diamond trade control sanctions, Russia-related sanctions, big area of attention right now, Somalia-related, Sudan, South Sudan, which is a new one that was just added, you know, Sudan split into two countries. The principal area of Sudan has always been sanctioned, but recently, the southern part of Sudan was sanctioned, which is a separate country. Syria sanctions, the transnational criminal organizations, Ukraine-related, Yemen-related, and Zimbabwe-related. So when we look at these 25, where we have the word related, what that means is that that entire country is not subject to sanctions. So there are certain individuals within that country that are sanctioned, and hence the word related. But where I don't use the word related, I'm talking about countries like Cuba, Iran, North Korea, Sudan, and Syria, those countries are sanctioned. So that's really the key to understanding this chart. Now, if we drill down a little bit further in these 25 sanctioned programs, we see, again, aside from the behavior-related, we have primarily country sanctions, and we have what I'll call list-based sanctions. And the list-based are individuals and entities that are named, they're designated as individuals of concern, and the terminology that's given to those parties is what we call SDN, which is another acronym, I'm full of those, and that stands for Specially Designated National. What countries are sanctioned? Well, there are really five. Burma, we still call Burma, believe it or not, it's Myanmar. But those sanctions are being rolled back because, you know, democracy is taking hold in Burma or Myanmar. And to reward the Burmese or Myanmar government for the democratization, we start to peel back some of the sanctions. So I still leave it in there because they don't just remove the sanctions. They leave them in place, but they overlay them with a general license, which means that while the activity is still prohibited, there's a general license that says you can do it, but at any time that general license can be yanked, and then we're back to having the prohibitions and the sanctions. So I leave Burma on this chart for that reason. But other than that, those five countries, the other five countries, are fully sanctioned. Cuba, comprehensive sanction program. Iran, comprehensive sanction program. North Korea, comprehensive. Sudan, the same, and Syria as well. Now, what do I mean by comprehensive? I mean everything's off limits. You can't invest there, you can't trade there, you can't import from there, you can't make wire transfers to there. Everything is off limit where the country is fully sanctioned. And why does OFAC sanction countries? Again, OFAC is using this foreign policy tool let's call it a drone, against countries that we don't like. We don't like their activities. You know, maybe they're involved in non-democratic efforts. Whatever reason, we don't like the activities of these countries, so we sanction them. Generally, the mantra is they are a threat to U.S. national security, a threat to U.S. foreign policy, a threat to the U.S. economy. And the countries fluctuate over time. So you'll notice I didn't include Libya in my grid, because Libya is no longer sanctioned. It was at one point when Muammar Gaddafi was in play, and Muammar Gaddafi, you know, was involved in activities we didn't like. We sanctioned Libya because of that. You'll also notice Iraq wasn't in my current chart, same reason. Saddam Hussein, we didn't like what Saddam Hussein was doing. We sanctioned a country, but now that's all changed. So Libya has been fully removed. Iraq has been fully removed. So they come and they go. I mean, I've been doing this a long time. And in the years that I've been doing this, you know, I've seen many countries be added to the list and many countries be removed from the list. But what we're left with now are basically those five. We call them the rogue countries: Cuba, Iran, North Korea, Sudan, and Syria. Decreasing threats result in a rollback of the sanctions. I mean, many times takes what I described in the form of Burma, where the rollback doesn't take place all at once. There's a general license. The sanctions are left in place just to kind of keep a check on things. What do OFAC country sanctions prohibit for those five countries? Basically everything. They're comprehensive sanctions. You cannot do direct activities, so no direct engaging in any dealings in or with an OFAC sanctioned country unless you get a license, but you'll never get a license. I mean, maybe there's some license granted for humanitarian reasons, but other than that, there's generally no licenses. So directly engaging in business in these countries or with these countries, but also indirectly, which is the killer. Because indirectly means there can be several parties in between you and the sanctioned country. It's also prohibited to evade or avoid the sanctions. And it's also prohibited to conduct or to engage in facilitation. Now, facilitation is a term of art. And what facilitation means is that a U.S. person cannot engage a foreign person to do activities in or with that sanctioned country that would be off limits if engaged in by a U.S. person. So facilitation. Now, many of the banking cases that you read recently involved evading or avoiding country sanctions. And generally, what those banks were doing is using their U.S. dollar correspondent bank accounts to transfer funds, you know, flush dollar funds through those accounts to beneficiaries in one of the sanctioned countries. And what they did, because a U.S. bank could never process a transaction that had the name of a sanctioned country in the SWIFT message, you know, SWIFT message being the, you know, the means by which instructions are given for wire transfers, a U.S. bank could never transfer or could never conclude or effect a transfer that's being made to a beneficiary in Iran because the U.S. bank is prohibited from doing that. So what the foreign banks did in many cases is camouflage or strip the names of the foreign countries from the wire transfer instructions so that the U.S. bank would effect the transaction, then not knowing that it was going to a beneficiary in one of these sanctioned countries. So that has been the reason for many of these fines of the banks. You'll notice that some of those banks are banks that have U.S. operations, and maybe they flushed their transfers through their U.S. banking presence. And in those instances, by the way, they were fined not only by OFAC, but also by the state of New York, the Division of Financial Services. But in other instances, the banks were totally foreign, and they were just found, even though they had no U.S. presence, they were found to have caused a U.S. bank to violate the sanctions by stripping the name of the beneficiary and the designated country from the wire transfer instruction. So that's really the background to all those articles you've seen probably recently about banks. So when you look at, you know, what is involved with an OFAC sanctioned country, everything is basically off limits. You can't do anything directly or indirectly. You can't evade or avoid. You can't facilitate. And now I'm going to get into a key term here, and that is, who is affected by these sanctions? Who is prohibited from engaging in transactions with these sanctioned countries? Usually the term of art that's used is U.S. person. But again, it's a term of art, and it's defined differently in the sanctioned programs. So you need to look at the sanctioned programs to see who exactly is a U.S. person. Now, for North Korea, Sudan, and Syria, which are the IEPA-based sanctions, the U.S. person is defined as a U.S. citizen wherever they sit. So a U.S. person here, or a U.S. person who's stationed in Germany, or a U.S. person worldwide is subject to these sanctions. U.S. legal entities are subject to these sanctions. So a U.S. company, a foreign company that has a U.S. subsidiary, that U.S. subsidiary would be subject to these sanctions. A foreign company that has a branch in the U.S., that branch would be subject to the U.S. sanctions. So foreign branches of U.S. entities also going the other way. So U.S. person, any legal entity in the U.S., any branch in the U.S., and for overseas, for North Korea, Sudan, and Syria, any branch of a U.S. entity, or any person located in the U.S. Now, that's for three sanction programs, North Korea, Sudan, and Syria. For Cuba and Iran, the definition is more comprehensive. And the definition of U.S. person for Cuba and Iran is not only the above, but also the foreign subsidiaries of U.S. companies. So you can have a German company that's the foreign subsidiary of a U.S. company, and that German company makes German-made product, German investments, and has no U.S. nexus, but that German company as the subsidiary of a U.S. company, U.S. person, is prohibited under these five sanction regimes. Examples of prohibited transactions that under OFAC country sanctions would be making direct or indirect, and indirect is very nebulous because an indirect connection can be established by OFAC very creatively. So making a direct or indirect investment in a sovereign debt instrument issued by the government of an OFAC sanctioned country, any company or entity located in making a direct or indirect investment in a company or entity that's located in an OFAC sanctioned country, or making a direct or indirect investment in a third-party fund or company whose profits are derived predominantly from an OFAC sanctioned country. Making investment decisions for an offshore fund when such investment decisions direct, authorize, or otherwise facilitate the offshore fund's investment in an OFAC sanctioned country. Now, there was recently a case that was really pretty newsworthy. And this case involved a company by the name of and is a U.S. person as defined in all the sanction programs because it's based in the U.S. was the investment manager for the Emerging Markets Fund, which is a Guernsey, U.K. organized investment fund, contracted with its London-based subsidiary, and the name of that subsidiary was. So they had contracted with through an investment advisory agreement pursuant to which provided fee-based investment services in relation to, again, you know, is the party on whose behalf was permitted to make investments. Well, in 2007, purchased shares in the First Persian Equity Fund, which was a Cayman Islands company. So look at the indirect connection here. You have a U.S. company, you have a U.K. company, you have a Cayman Islands company making an investment in a Persian investment fund, and that Persian investment fund invested exclusively in Iran securities. And OFAC determined that this was a violation by, because first of all, should have screened these investments that it was charged with making to ensure that they weren't made in Iran or for the benefit of Iran. And because it did not screen and because the investment occurred, was fined, subject to an OFAC penalty. So that's an interesting case, and I think it shows you how tangential these connections can be. Now, it was a case that really raised a lot of eyebrows, and many people didn't quite understand the case when it came out because it was so tangential, so attenuated from the U.S., but in the end, it was held to be an OFAC violation. Now, that deals with the countries. So, you know, when you're investing, you need to make sure that you're not taking money from these countries and you're not investing in these countries. That's the country sanction program. But remember, there are 19 other sanction programs which are called list-based sanction programs. Now, this gets into where the country itself is not subject to a comprehensive embargo but rather individuals or entities within that country have been named as parties of concern. And they've been named as parties of concern and placed on a list which is called the Specially Designated National List, which is voluminous. If you want to take a look at this list, you can go onto OFAC's website and you'll see that this goes on for pages and pages, and there's a search tool, and you could search on there by, you know, countries if you want to see who in a particular country has been sanctioned. So these are the list-based sanction programs, and of course the one that's getting the greatest attention right now, well, two, the Russian-related sanctions. Now, Russia, entities within Russia, individuals within Russia, were initially sanctioned because of, you may remember, the fate of a Mr. Magnitsky, who was a rival, an enemy of Putin. He was held to have violated Russian tax law. He was imprisoned, and while he was in prison, he was denied medical care, and he ultimately died. So the U.S. was outraged by this, and so we sanctioned a number of individuals in relation to Magnitsky, Mr. Magnitsky's demise. So that was the first basis of the Russian sanction, Russian-related sanctions. But more recently, there have been many, many, many sanctions levied by the U.S. in relation to the Ukraine situation. And U.S. is rolling out these sanctions one by one. And initially, we sanctioned maybe, I don't know, seven individuals and one entity. And since then, we've rolled out several other programs. And our target seems to be Russian oligarchs. You know, that seems to be where we are basing the bulk of our Ukraine-related sanctions at this point. Now, in addition to our sanctions, the EU is sanctioning Russian-related or Ukraine-related individuals and entities, as is Canada, as is Australia, and the list goes on and on. The repercussions of the Ukraine-related activity is significant, and it has resulted in sanctions levied against individuals and entities, not only by the U.S., but by many other countries. Keep a watch. That list will continue to expand. I was just at OFAC yesterday, and there's word that more sanctions will result. What that means is that if you see an individual or an entity that's been designated as a specially designated national and added to OFAC's list, that means that you can't deal with them. OFAC sanctions individuals and entities when they're determined to constitute a threat to national security, U.S. foreign policy, and U.S. economy. And these list-based sanctions fluctuate over time, and they're immediate. They're announced in the Federal Register, and they're effective immediately. So there's no grace period. They're effective immediately, and that means if you're dealing with a sanctioned party, or a party that ultimately ends up being sanctioned, you can no longer deal with that party. But it's not so simple, as we'll see in a few minutes. Now, who must comply with these list-based sanctions? Again, we're dealing with the term U.S. person, term of art, which in this case means U.S. citizens, wherever they're located, and permanent residents. So you get a green card, you're a U.S. person for these sanctions. U.S. legal entities, foreign branches of U.S. entities, and any persons or entities that happen to be located in the U.S. Foreign subs of U.S. companies are not included in the definition of U.S. persons for this OFAC sanction list. But remember, a U.S. person can engage in facilitation. In other words, by referring to its foreign entity or foreign sub, an activity that itself could not do because of the sanctions. So we need to always keep facilitation in mind, as well as evasion or avoidance. If you are a U.S. person, and all of you sitting in this room probably fall within that, and your companies do as well if they're based in the U.S., you must block the assets of a specially designated national if those assets are in the U.S. or they come into your possession. You are prohibited from engaging in any investment dealings with an SDN, from taking money from an SDN to make an investment, to making an investment in an entity that is an SDN. Additionally, and this is where OFAC really gets treacherous, OFAC has they call it a position that occurs by operation of law, where an SDN is sanctioned, but also sanctioned are any entities that are 50% or more owned by that SDN. Now those, the ones that are sanctioned by virtue of the ownership, 50% or more, they're not named as SDNs, but that means that you have to dig around and find out what an SDN owns, which gets very complicated in the case of the Russian sanctions, the Russian oligarchs, because they have many investments. And so what you'll find, if there's a certain Russian individual that's been sanctioned, you need to look at what that individual owns. The Russian oligarchs own many properties, many companies. To the extent that their ownership interest is 50% or more, that entity itself is sanctioned in the same manner as the SDN, which means that you can't deal with that 50% or more owned entity. You must exercise caution when dealing with entities that don't fall under that rubric of ownership, 50% or more. It would be less than 50% ownership, but control. Control that's exercised either by the number of the board of directors or the decision-making authority or who actually controls that company. So where you have an entity that's not 50% or more owned but is controlled by an SDN, you need to be cautious because at any point, OFAC could also sanction that person. I'm not making this up. It almost seems so extreme that I tell this to people and they look at me like, you're making this up. And I'm not. This is a policy that OFAC follows. They say it's by operational law, but we ask what law, and we haven't been able to get clarity on that. But it is what it is, and this is what OFAC is enforcing. And so what happened several weeks ago, OFAC had a forum. There were 700 people at that forum. From the podium, OFAC clarified this 50% rule, which has only been around since 2008. And they clarified the rule, and they said it was 50% or more ownership. So somehow that got back to Russia. And so the oligarchs then started to divest their ownership interest. So it went all of a sudden from 50% or more to 42%, lesser amount than 50%. Now, OFAC said we deal in ownership, but that was a charge to the beneficiary, the recipients of the sanctioned activity, and they, in fact, have started to divest. Now, OFAC has kind of retrenched on that hard line, 50% or more ownership, and they've said, well, we want to see proof that divestment occurred. Well, how do you get proof that divestment occurred in Russia of a Russian company? It's almost impossible. So this is where we stand with the Russian sanctions, more and more being added. They imply or they also encompass entities that are 50% or more owned by those sanctioned parties. And this is not just Russia. These are on all the sanction programs, by the way. And anything that's controlled, caution, because that could ultimately be put on OFAC's list. Now, that's important for you as you're investing, you're taking money to invest, or you're investing money, because if a party is sanctioned, it's sanctioned immediately, and that means from that point on, you can't continue with that investment, and you also can't divest that investment, because either one requires approval from OFAC. I just go through this scenario because it's almost unbelievable, this application of the 50% rule. So you have Mr. A, who's designated as an SDN by OFAC, and Mr. A owns 60% of Company B, and Company B owns 40% of Company D, and Mr. A also owns 45% of Company C, and Company C owns 60% of Company D. Who and what is blocked under this 50% rule? Well, as we look at Company B, clearly Company B is going to be blocked, because if you remember, Mr. A owns 60% of Company B, and because of that 60% ownership, Company B is blocked. But he also owned, if you remember, 45% of Company C. Well, 45% is not 50%, so Company C is not blocked by this operation of the 50% rule. But what about Company D? D, if you remember, was owned by portion by B and portion by C. Well, Mr. A owns 24% effectively of Company D through his 60% ownership in Company B. And if you remember, Company B owns 40% of Company D. That just gets to that result by multiplying 60% times 40%. And so Mr. A owns 24% of Company D. Mr. A also owns indirectly, so these are indirect ownerships. And again, I say indirect is always the killer. He owns indirectly 27% of Company D through his 45% ownership in Company C, which in turn, if you remember, owns 60% of Company D. So you multiply that out, 45% times 60% equals 27%. So if you look at Mr. A, indirectly he owns 24% of Company D, and by virtue of his ownership in Company B, and 27% ownership of Company D by virtue of his ownership of Company C. And so when you add those two together, 27 and 24, you find out that Mr. A owns 51% of Company D. Hence, Company D is also sanctioned by virtue of this 50% rule. So even though he doesn't have any direct ownership of Company D, his 51% ownership interest of Company D by virtue of his other ownership interests results in OFAC deeming Company D to be one of these shadow SDNs. So what's the summary here? Mr. A, designated by OFAC, he was named, specially named. You look on the list, you'll see his name, Mr. A. Company B was deemed by OFAC to be an SDN because Mr. A owned 50% or more. And here's another interesting twist. SDN status of Company B, again, which Mr. A owns 60% of, what about the 40% owner? Doesn't matter. The whole company, Company B, is deemed to be an SDN because of Mr. A's 60% interest without regard to ownership by somebody else to the extent of 40%, and that other person was not sanctioned. So it colors the whole investment in Company B. So this SDN status applies to the entire Company B without regard to the 40% ownership interest by some other person who's not sanctioned in Company B. Continuing with our summary, Company C is not deemed by OFAC to be an SDN because it's less than 50% owned by Mr. A, but Company D is indirectly owned by Mr. A to the extent of 51% by his ownership in those other companies. One additional consideration, and this came up recently because there were two Russian brothers, two Russian friends of Putin, who were recently named as SDNs. And so one bank had issued MasterCard and Visa services to this Russian bank that was owned by these Russian brothers. And so the bank ceased providing the MasterCard and Visa credit card services, only to learn that OFAC aggregates the ownership of an individual SDN. They don't combine familial relationships. So we had two brothers, Mr. A owning 38% of Company E, and his brother, Mr. Z, who was also an SDN, owns 38% of Company E. So 38 and 38 gives you 76, but that's not the test. The test is individual SDN ownership, not aggregated SDN ownership. So Company E is not an SDN, and hence the bank that had stopped providing the MasterCard and Visa services to the Russian bank was back in business. And that's the position of OFAC. So Company E is not blocked for now, but you need to consider, again, always the possibility of facilitation or evasion. What we have is ownership is automatic, immediate blocking, 50% or more. Control is less than 50% ownership, but the sanctioned party exercises control, and that considered by OFAC to be a cautionary situation. You need to be on the lookout, but that's important because if you're taking money from someone to invest and you're investing and something changes where you can no longer provide those services, it puts you in a predicament because you're really in a catch-22. Some prohibited transactions under OFAC's list-based sanctions would be opening an account for an SDN, trading on behalf of an SDN, making direct or indirect investments in debt instruments issued by an SDN or the equity of a company or an entity that's an SDN. And remember, it's not just the named SDN, but also the deemed or the shadow SDNs. Or foreign investment funds, making a direct or indirect investment in foreign investment funds or exchanges that are not subject to U.S. jurisdiction and may as a result have investments in SDNs. Penalties. OFAC imposes penalties on a civil and criminal basis. And the difference being a civil basis are for unintentional, inadvertent violations. You deal with an SDN, you didn't know he was an SDN, it's a violation because there's a strict liability standard. You don't have to know that the party's an SDN, you mainly have to deal with the SDN. That's a civil violation. It's on a strict liability basis, and that means that ignorance of the law, ignorance of the fact that this party or company was an SDN, it's not going to set you free. And so the civil penalties are up to the greater of $250,000 per violation, so per SDN investment, or twice the dollar value of the amount of the transaction at issue. And this is per violation, and this is unintentional, inadvertent situations. A criminal violation, on the other hand, is a knowing, intentional, willful violation made with a disregard for the law. You know that this party's an SDN, but you don't cease dealing with them because it's inconvenient. That's a criminal violation, and that is subject to $1 million per violation and or imprisonment up to 20 years per violation, and a criminal violation is an intentional willful violation. That is a pretty significant penalty. So if a hedge fund is a U.S. person, a hedge fund must comply with OFAC sanctions. U.S. person, not something you can opt out of. You have to comply with OFAC sanctions. And again, you need to keep in mind that there are country sanctions, those big five, direct or indirect dealings with Cuba, Iran, North Korea, Sudan, and Syria, but also list-based sanctions. So you really need to be screening the parties from whom you take money and the parties in whom you make investments. Most companies, most investment companies, most hedge funds, or many, are learning that they need to develop OFAC compliance procedures. Now, these are basically screening procedures. You need to, or you should, screen direct investors and direct investments on an initial basis at the time you take the money or you make the investment, and on an ongoing basis, because at any time, party can be added to this list. To ensure that, first of all, this party is not located in an OFAC-sanctioned country, this party is not a named, specifically named or designated SDN, this party is not 50% or more owned by an SDN, and really, for your own benefit, this party is not controlled by an SDN, because if they're controlled, there's always that threat that OFAC will make them an SDN, and that's not a situation you want to be in. If the initial screening of the investor or the investment, the direct investment, indicates that an OFAC sanction issue exists, either because of the country or because of the party, you shouldn't proceed with that investment, because proceeding will be a violation. If your initial screening is clean, in other words, at the time you enter the relationship with the investor, at the time you make the investment, that party is clean, but later on they're added to the sanction list, you need to terminate the direct investor or relationship with the direct investor or the direct investment, because otherwise it will be an OFAC violation. But you can't just terminate, because, again, you can't deal with a sanctioned country or a sanctioned party, and dealing with it would be selling the investment or disengaging from the relationship. So you need to consult OFAC on a path forward to get OFAC guidance on how to proceed. And this is, again, for sanctions that result after you enter into a relationship. For ones that exist before you enter into a relationship or an investment, you just don't proceed. But this is the ongoing screening. Now, many companies, many funds, financial investments use interdiction software where they screen. So when the initial relationship is entered, that is screened to make sure that there's no sanctioned country situation or no sanctioned party relationship. And then after the name is entered into the database, the screening is ongoing, automatic. And so it kicks out, you know, if a new party is sanctioned, so that you know. So that's really the best way to proceed, because it's not just the initial relationship, it's also the ongoing relationship. So you need to conduct a due diligence on an initial and an ongoing basis, and the best way to do it is to get one of these interdiction screening programs, because it's impossible to manage otherwise. You need to also consider the beneficial ownership, you know, which you probably may have through, you know, some other means of when you open the relationship, maybe anti-money laundering programs. You need to seek OFAC compliance certifications. In other words, when you take money, you want to get a certification. We're not a sanctioned party. We're not in a sanctioned country. And you want to also seek OFAC compliance indemnification. Now, that's just a contractual remedy. That won't prevent an OFAC violation, but it will give you some contractual recourse if things change in a way you don't like. When using investment managers, again, you should get their OFAC compliance certifications, and many of you probably get side letters all the time or have to issue side letters about this, and seek an OFAC compliance indemnification. If you are in receipt of funds of a blocked party or an SDN, you need to create or issue blocked fund reports. There are record-keeping requirements in relation to, you know, all these dealings. And there are successor liability concerns. So if you acquire another company, you need to investigate that company's OFAC compliance history. Because to the extent that there are OFAC compliance problems in that target company, they will become your liability. They will pass to you on a successor liability basis, and that has been upheld. So it's important to do a good vetting of any company that you're looking at purchasing, because that will help you maneuver through these crazy regulations, which, as I said, we will have more sanctions are anticipated in relation to Ukraine. So I have a few minutes to spare, and I'm happy to take any questions. Yes, sir.
Do transactions in derivatives also count as prohibited transactions?
Yeah, OFAC takes a very broad view, direct, indirect, property interest. I mean, what is underlying? They take a very broad view. And there's always a, fact and circumstance test for them. They really dig into the background. Now, how does this come to OFAC's attention, you may want to know? Well, with the banks, the foreign banks that you saw, they were reported by the banks that made the transactions. So there's always that process, that if a bank is receiving money in connection with one of your transactions, they are actually required to report that. So that may be how it comes to the surface, or it could be, the old disgruntled employee situation or competitor situation. They come to the surface, and at that point, you're in a difficult position, because when OFAC comes to you, you're on the defensive. If you find a situation, it happens. There's a process for making a disclosure, make a voluntary disclosure to OFAC. And if your problem is not systemic, in other words, you had an oops moment, something occurred, you didn't plan it, you have compliance procedures, it just was an oops moment, they usually close that without any action. And so it kind of wipes the slate clean. So that's really the best way to be. You're in the best situation. Yes, sir.
Is Ukraine a recent addition to that list?
Ukraine is not. Now, these are related. So if you remember, in the beginning, I said there's some sanctions programs that are related. So there's Ukraine related, Russian related, Crimea related. The countries themselves are not sanctioned, but entities within those countries are sanctioned. Now, there's a side story to this, which I'll just mention because that's a good point. So what happened? Crimea annexed itself to Russia. So companies in Crimea now, if they had a headquarters in Ukraine and they had a headquarters in Russia, they want to go to the Russian headquarters. So what's happening now is another U.S. government agency called the Commerce Department is sanctioning those Crimean entities because they're saying they participated in this nationalization. And they're sanctioned by being put, believe it or not, on another list that's called the entity list. And that means basically, U.S. party can't have anything to do with them, but under a separate regime. So I didn't want to. I mean, there are other regimes. I mentioned OFAC, which is the bulk of it. But their Commerce Department has what we call bad guys, these Crimean entities that annex themselves to Russian headquarters. Then there are states. You may be within a state where you're not permitted to invest public investment proceeds or public retirement funds in a sanctioned country. So many states have legislation like that. So that's, again, a sideshow. I didn't get into that, but it's important to keep that in mind. Thank you for your attention to this.
To listen to other panels from the 2014 7th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit Podcast Central at morganlewis.com. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefundsresources.